Welcome back to Reformed Millennials, the podcast where finances, economic trends, and sports intersect. Cam and Joel help listeners better invest their time and money. Also, it's important for listeners to understand that investing in equities, fixed income instruments, and/or alternative asset classes involves substantial risk of loss. Any action you may take as a result of the information presented in this podcast is your own responsibility. The information in this podcast is presented as a general educational, informational, and entertainment resource only. While Joel is registered to provide investment advice, this podcast does not provide individualized investment, tax, or insurance advice, nor is it meant as a recommendation to any listener to buy or sell any specific securities or otherwise take any other form of investment action. This is an excerpt of the full legal disclaimer that's available on the landing page of this podcast, which includes whether Cam Pitchers or Joel Shackleton have any ownership or interest in the specific securities discussed in this podcast.
Melissa, welcome back to the pod. Long time no talk. It's always lovely to get you on and to have a conversation with you outside of friendship and to talk about what you do for a living on a day-to-day basis. For those that don't know, Mel is the founder of MC Consulting and the founder of Pocket Lobbyist. Before the end of our recording, I would love for you to talk a little bit about that because I find it to be the only place that I can read about Alberta politics that doesn't feel as though there's a ton of bias to it. And I really appreciate that about you.
Well, thank you, Joel. And thanks for having me. It's good to see you again. I feel like budgets always bring us together. It's like the money of the province, the money of people that you're advising and talking to, it all works in together.
So I want to set a table here and feel free to add things to it. Because for me, this is how I view politics, or I view budgeting, and it's important for me to say what I say and then have this as a backdrop. So from my perspective, the reason why Alberta has been a desirable place for people to move to is because our social services, our economy, job availability and affordability of homes and standard of living are all in the top quartile or the top of our country. And because of that, it's largely a result of our great natural resource sector, but also the last 100 years of investing in infrastructure. And I think that most people don't understand, and you just mentioned this prior to coming on, the per capita spend on social services is the highest in the country. And most people think that either work in them or are receiving them think that we aren't doing it and that we aren't paying attention or spending and that it's not enough money, when relatively compared to the other provinces, we actually are outspending them. Now, are we getting a better result? I can't say one way or the other because I've never actually lived in any of the other provinces. I've been to them, but I don't know if we are getting a better result. I think we are, but I would like to hear from you what your take is on the most recent budget. We'll start to throw some figures out there, but I think we should move through a lot of the more important files as we chat. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it sounds good. It's, yeah, budget 2024 in Alberta tabled on February 29th. While there was a lot in budget that we sort of anticipated and knew was coming, and as a Pocket Lobbyist newsletter subscriber, I'm sure you saw some of that in what we were previewing. There's some stuff in there that's new, some stuff that we were anticipating, and we can definitely get into that. But I think you raise a really good point in terms of thematically how Albertans sort of view themselves and view their relationship and interactions with the budget and the government generally. I've lived in Alberta for most of my life and spent a few years in British Columbia, as you know, and I do a decent amount of travel in Canada for work, as you guys do. I thought for a long time before ever leaving the province that all of the things that you just mentioned, really good quality healthcare, high per capita spend on social services, low cost of living, economic opportunities, I thought those were the things that were driving what was so great about Alberta. But I think that I have sort of shifted the way that I think about that now. I think that there is something in Alberta. And I don't know if it's a chicken and egg thing, if the things that you mentioned create this or if it's something else, but there is this really uniquely Alberta innovative entrepreneurial, you know, spirit that exists in this province that I don't think exists anywhere else. And I think it has been the reason for much of our economic success, much of our successes in healthcare, education. And I think that for a long time, we always had, you know, perhaps up until 2014, which was a decade ago already, we never really had to worry about the inputs to take care of the outputs. But we are definitely reaching a point now with global economic uncertainty, with some of the oil and gas assets and royalty structures kind of coming more to the end of their operation, which changes how much royalties we're getting, global price of oil in terms of global uncertainty that we can talk about, as well as just massive population growth and just inflation and increasing costs of everything. We're now in a position where the government has to make choices and trade-offs. And I don't know that Albertans are used of thinking of most things from a place of scarcity, which I think is a good thing because that creates a really amazing and unique spirit. But it is a reality with the dollars and cents when we, you know, get into it. And I know we were talking about this right before we pressed record, but if we are a province that wants to pride ourselves on no sales tax, low tax affordability, then you know, getting off of that resource revenue roller coaster does necessitate that we look at the Heritage Savings Trust Fund and other forms of investments to create less of a volatile state. So those are my thoughts, but yeah, happy to get into it.
Let's start with the trust fund because it's the most interesting thing for me, shocker. However, I was just at a lunch where Nate Horner kind of took questions, had a fireside chat, and had a presentation on their budget. And that budget topic was, and of course, this was more of a entrepreneur business-based lunch, and he was speaking to a lot of the business leaders in downtown core, and he was referencing all the things that they probably want to hear. And the first question was obviously taxes, and why wasn't there a tax cut in 2025? But I want to avoid that first. Because he said an interesting thing to me, and it was currently the Heritage Fund is sitting at around $20 billion, and they're forecasting it will hit 23.8 by the end of 2024 in value. He had commented that past returns have been right around that 8.5 range, and that they're forecasting a 2050 valuation of $250 billion in that fund without any contributions, but just a reinvestment of capital. And I was kind of running some of the compound values on what we're currently at, and I don't really see how they're going to hit that. But I'm more interested around, okay, we get to $250 billion. Is that number is supposed to displace the oil revenue? How?
So interesting question. So a couple of points to what you're saying. So the Heritage Savings Trust Fund has a really unique and long history since 1976 when it was first established. When it was first established, the point of it was to create that sustainability, which would mean that investment income that came from the trust fund during times of uncertainty or where oil resource revenue didn't meet what was projected, it would make it so that the government didn't have to draw on a deficit or increase taxes, creating sort of a cushion. Now, over the past several years, the contributions to the Heritage Savings Trust Fund and the allotment, I guess, of the investment income from that fund had caused it to, I guess, not grow as much as it could have if that investment income was retained. Last year, the government introduced legislation as part of their broader fiscal framework that requires any government surpluses to be spent in a very specific way. And one of the ways in which those surpluses can be allocated is by putting money into the Heritage Savings Trust Fund. And they also necessitate that investment income must be retained in the fund to grow it. So I think that I don't think that they anticipate they will not be contributing to the trust fund. In a sort of ideal world, they're taking surpluses as they did this year and for future years and dividing it between debt repayment and the Heritage Savings Trust Fund.
Okay, so I see the compounding ability here.
What were the numbers that you ran, by the way? Did it get even remotely close to that number? I'm like not the math person.
At their current compounding rate, it's not going to get there. However, however, if there is a $2 billion contribution annually, they will.
Interesting.
So it's all about capital retention. And if they are seeing surpluses, which they're anticipating, they're going to have a $400 million surplus and then a 1.4 and a 1.2 or something like that over the next 3 years. And that obviously includes a contribution to Heritage Fund. They're going to get there. And I actually really, I'm encouraged by it. But what I think is occurring out in public is that anyone who pays just a tiny little bit of attention and not nearly as much as you are, they're going to see the $2 billion being thrown into this fund, not really understand what it's all about and what it's supposed to be for. I think it sounds good and Albertans like it, but they don't really get it. They're seeing this $2 billion and then they're going to also hear from all of their friends and family that the healthcare system's collapsing. And as an Edmontonian who just came back from a lunch with the finance minister, it sounds as though they're continuing to kick the can down the road and they're restructuring. And for the last four elections, I've heard about restructuring of healthcare. How many more times do we need to hear restructuring of healthcare? Because when are they going to get good at it? Because they haven't, clearly. And it's not my, I think it's, in my opinion, not a restructuring problem necessarily as much as there needs to be a significant capital investment into the infrastructure side. It's always deemed to be salaries and billables and people. I think that there's a huge problem in the with around the reality that we do not have enough beds in this province.
Yeah, so that is a very interesting point that you raise, and I think that there's some merit to it for sure. There's probably a lot of merit to it, actually. I want to address the healthcare situation because you're right. There have been so many different restructures of healthcare in the province. The last one that we saw was in 2008 when it was Premier Ed Stelmach, and they consolidated regional health authorities into AHS, which was basically a super board at this point, which manages healthcare presently, policy, delivery, et cetera, all across the province. So we have a centralized healthcare system with AHS, or had at least until they announced this refocus, which is unlike what you see in other provinces where it's more regional based. And I think post-COVID and through COVID, there was, at least on the account of the government that we have now, there was a perception that the system itself was not designed to handle what we saw during COVID or handle sort of surge capacity. And on the beds topic, this government will talk a lot about, I think they will admit that there is a bed issue, but it's because we don't have proper functioning of long-term care or people who need mental health supports, et cetera. And now I don't work in the healthcare system. And I know that when you're actually in the healthcare system, it's much different than just reading about it or talking about it. But I think what's different, and time will tell whether or not it's a good change or not, I think what's different about what the government has announced with their healthcare refocus is an acknowledgement first that policy and health policy should probably be made by elected officials and not administrators, because the only way that you can actually hold the people who are closest to delivering healthcare, or not delivering healthcare, but closest to healthcare policy to account, is if it's the elected officials that are making those decisions. Previous to making this announcement, you know, it's not that the government had no power, like the Minister of Health would have no power, but there was a big divide between health policy being made by the minister, health policy being made by AHS. And so whether or not you agree with that change or not, and there's probably great arguments on both sides, the thought process, I think, for this refocus is to bring the policymaking back into the government realm and then create these four agencies that are specialized in acute care, primary care, long-term care, and mental health and addiction, which, you know, could create more division within the healthcare system or could improve it. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise, but I think that the biggest change now is that Alberta Health Services will not be the sort of overarching body of healthcare delivery in the province. They will be an element of the acute care organization that delivers hospital services. So that I think is a big change that we're seeing, and time will tell, I suppose, if it will make a difference, but certainly we're not going to see a difference for another couple of years until everything shakes out.
Yeah, the healthcare file is really intimidating for me. The way in which I see it is through the eyes of my wife and through the mm-hmm. eyes of my family members and clients. I work with a ton of healthcare workers and physicians, and I sympathize because of it. And then I hear from the oil and gas side of my clientele, and then I see such a divide. And I think a lot of it is, truthfully, they're talking past each other, both groups, mm-hmm. in many ways. And I'm hopeful that there can be a meet in the middle somewhere, where there's people that have run efficient businesses that think that they can come into the most complex system and just overhaul it. And I'm not sure what the right answer is. I do believe that infrastructure is unquestionable, that's a requirement. And it's nice to see a focus on mental health, because that is something that I think a lot of on both sides of the aisle they've been asking for. So it's nice to see. Now, moving down the importance of files, I would like to talk about education. And it seems as though there was a big bump there. Did you feel that way too?
Yes. So in the actual operational budget, I think is like a 5% bump. And then of course the capital investments that they've made, I think it's like 2.1 or 2.2 billion and up, I think almost 500 million from the commitments they made last year. So I think there's definitely one thing that I have noticed over the past few budget cycles is that there's definitely an acknowledgement of the way that children and young people have suffered over the past few years, and not due to anybody's fault, but just like there's been so much change that, I mean, kids have such different and complex issues to deal with. And we also have this huge population growth, and Alberta's always been a young province as well. So I think that there's definitely an acknowledgement that needs to be supported within the sector. And so I was definitely happy to see a lot of those increases. I truly do think that education is the one place where if you wanted to make big improvements that you could see throughout society for years to come, that's the place to invest. And so I am definitely very happy that they did.
Yeah, you could see it was a focus of this current government. And I don't think many expected that. So kudos from my seat anyways. I'm open to other people kind of emailing me and being like, no, you're dumb, you missed this. And maybe that's true. But it seems like there's a nice focus there.
Just to play devil's advocate for the people who may be saying that there wasn't enough done there, the argument, I guess, against there wasn't enough done is that if you add what the government's calculation of CPI, so inflation, and what population growth is, if you add those two numbers together, that equals about 6.1%. And so if you wanted to say that anything less than 6.1% is a cut, I suppose you could take
that. You say that about everything.
You could, absolutely. But I think if just to play the devil's advocate, and this is not necessarily my position, but I think that's where people would point to it wasn't enough if they were going to say that.
Yeah. And I think a glaring problem for me is seeing the GDP and revenue growth it's not outpacing inflation, which means that we're shrinking. And that didn't come with any sort of significant tax cuts. It's because we're not generating enough revenue and efficiencies, and GDP growth in this province is not good enough. And this is a big thing that just dropped today, actually, the Globe and Mail article where they're talking about the efficiency growth in Canada and how we're no longer one of the wealthiest countries in like the G30. And that's a problem. And obviously, we could drone on and probably talk a lot longer about why that's happening. And we you and I likely have fairly similar theories on why, but that is a problem. And I didn't have a chance to mention that when I was at this lunch, but I felt as though that was something I wanted to kind of bring up to you and talk about, because the top line growth revenue number is a problem. They have a 2026 goal to reduce the tax rate at $60,000 from 10 to 8 or 10 to 9 to 8. Is that right?
Yeah. And the bracket under 60.
Right. And that that obviously hits everybody because, well, not everybody, but everybody who's like all the way up. It's a scaled system. And that is a significant tax cut. It's supposed to generate over $1 billion in, or I should say, save taxpayers greater than $1 billion a year. That's a lot. So that's not nothing. But if we aren't seeing a top line growth number, I don't know how we're going to be able to keep up with inflation and continue to do these things without seeing significant growth in our oil revenues generated.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I think actually even when we chatted in, like, I think it was budget 2021 or something like that about the federal budget, I feel like we were talking about this then where, yeah, Canada, to be a country, you know, that is competitive globally and that can keep up with inflation, you have to be growing your productivity. And I think that there's sometimes not enough focus on that. And it's just not something that you immediately notice as a problem. It's just sort of one of those numbers like, oh, okay, you know, real deep is only up, you know, from 2.5 to 2.9, like big deal. But, you know, when inflation is higher than that, and when there's population growth, like we just, I think that it's a huge part of why Alberta in particular was so successful, innovation, job creation, economic activity. And I think that we have to, just like we're investing into the Heritage Savings Trust Fund, we have to invest in that pipeline of individuals growing to
education.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Education. I'm a big believer in infrastructure spend, and we're not doing it at all. There's no infrastructure spend. Building roads does not create innovation. And they, Horner mentioned that the person who tabled a $5 billion, 400 bed hospital should be fired. And I quipped back saying that that's outrageous. I mean, you pump $5 billion into this province. You think that you're not going to get any of that back? And I understand that it's an overspend, and it's probably you're blowing a budget in some capacity. And like that capital is maybe not the most effective way to invest it. I'm promising you that will be seen back, and you will see a huge bump over a 3-year period in revenues generated in at the top line of our budget. And I would like to see that mindset hit the Conservative Party a little bit more than it has in the past. I was really encouraged by this. And in his conversation in Fireside Chat, he talked about debt. So this is the next big thing, right? They're retiring a lot of debt. It sounds like they've done close to or above $16 billion over their term.
Yeah.
That's really good, right? And we're currently sitting at, what was the number? Close to $76 billion. Is that right, Mel?
Yeah, that sounds right. I have it right here.
In tax, like in obligations to the taxpayer. So when you compare that to the other provinces, and maybe you know this better than me, because I don't know for sure. So for 2024, it's $78.4 billion in taxpayer-supported debt. That is down significantly from the past. Last year, we had a massive budget surplus. What is the GDP to debt ratio? Not net debt, but the actual gross debt ratio for all these other provinces. Because I know, if I were to guess, outside of maybe Saskatchewan, we are definitely the least indebted of all of the other provinces. Do you think that that's true?
Yes. And most like public finance sort of stipulates people started talking a lot about net debt to GDP ratios being, you know, no more than 30% is okay for.
And we're at 9.5 or something.
Yeah. Yeah. For other provinces, they are definitely higher up. I don't know exactly what everybody is, but definitely most provinces are in those like high teens and 20s, and the feds are over 30, I think, by my last calculation. We don't know when their budget's going to be next, but you bring up a really good point. So in those other provinces, they have sales taxes and they have higher income taxes and they have, you know, toll roads and all these other ways in which they are extracting more certain revenue from the people who are living there. And so this goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning as well. If we want to be a province that does not have those types of extra added costs, then we need more than other provinces to not have debt, because those debt servicing costs, as we've seen, you know, for individuals who are carrying, you know, debt through their mortgages or other debt in their own household, we've seen how interest rates have really impacted spending capacity. And that's the same for provinces. And we can't do that if we want to not increase costs for other for taxes, et cetera. So this is the sort of choice that it comes down to is like, yes, debt is bad. Ours is much less than other jurisdictions in Canada, but the reason why it can be, the reason why we can do other things. Exactly. So it's kind of by necessity. So I don't know what you think about that, but.
Yeah. I mean, from a debt to GDP ratio, I've always long been a believer that Alberta will outlive me. It'll outlive my children. And
you believe that? Wow. That's so like philosophical of you.
Yeah. I mean, and you treat a province and a government like a entity that lives forever in the same way that AIMCO treats our pension plan, like a, something that lives forever. Your investment philosophy and your debt philosophy is different, right? For a homeowner, you want to retire your mortgage at some point mm-hmm. because you will one day not work and you need to take that risk off your balance sheet. Whereas in a government, retiring all of your debt is actually a deleveraging and a poor idea. And you should be reinvesting for the future long term. That's why infrastructure spend is important. And when you, and you make a good point because this does go against what I would push back and push the other direction in saying that we don't have a high enough debt to GDP ratio. And that I think that we should be making larger investments when we are able to finance debt at 4.5%, 4.75%. And we should be issuing $2.5 billion in bonds and building a hospital. And to me, that's what, how I would treat it. And it would be really, really, it wouldn't be received really well, I think, because most people are obsessed with, oh no, I have a mortgage for 30 years. My house needs to be paid off. So does our government's debt. And that actually ends up in a poor return. Apple Computers has hundreds of billions of dollars in cash and has debt. Leverage matters and it's important. It ends up being a tool. So that's my theory with it all. It was nice to hear Horner actually mention that and that he feels like it's something that they're cognizant of, but they aren't focused on more than the reinvestment plan. And he was very much looking forward into the future. And I didn't expect him to say something like that. So that was really, that was encouraging.
Yeah, I think that reinvestment is super important. But again, it just sort of goes to when, like, Alberta was actually in a very, very precarious financial spot when COVID happened, when oil was being negatively. Like, it was, this is the thing too, is I think that people think that governments have this like finite ability to borrow, and they don't, like, not provincial governments, at least. Like, I don't know the economics federally, but, you know, Alberta.
We also don't either. You know, the only people that can, and this is just my opinion, but many believe this to be true. And the reason why America is a superpower, it's because they have the world reserve currency.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a reserve currency, you actually cannot borrow in infinity.
Exactly. And so there actually were situations where oil was so low that we were in a very, very precarious financial situation. And so because, like, oil revenues this year are down, they're about 17 or so billion dollars. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of assets where the way in which our royalty structure works, you know, a lot of the royalties paid at the beginning. And so as these assets live on mm-hmm. and we collect less and less from them. So if we want to not, like, again, this is roller coaster stuff, right? So if we want to not be on that, then we need to not be leveraged.
So this is, I'm going to avoid the natural disaster portion. They have a huge outlay for that, which is probably a good idea, given that yeah. the whole province is already on fire. So I want to chat a little bit about that situation, the situation around the resource problem. And you had mentioned that there, and I don't know a lot about this personally. I'm interested to know where this is headed because they've taken a stand against renewables in a way.
I will correct you in that they have not. We can talk more about that. Okay,
No, and that's good. You should know, yeah. You definitely know this better than me. My perception of this situation is that renewables, I mean, EVs are now have a $200 tax, which is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. But the second thing is that you now can't build windmills and sight lines. And the big gotcha was that, well, 30 years ago, they were building coal plants on mountains, but now we can't build windmills in farmers' fields. And I would like to know where I'm wrong on that. And in that headline, it grabs the public, especially the left side, and they run with it. And I'm sitting here being like, well, that sounds terrible. And I'd love to hear what the reality of that situation is, because as you say, our revenues are in that $16 to $20 billion range for what's generated from oil on an annual basis. That's huge. But if we're not drilling new wells and expanding the available resources of our oil and gas companies who are paying these royalties, if they're just burning down assets and not going to return, well, we need to find a replacement for that $16, $17, $20 billion worth of revenue every year. Where does it come from?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a lot to unpack there. That's okay. So I think with respect to the renewable situation, so a lot of people think that the ban, which was there was an update on that this week because they had a deadline to that. So we have some more clarity on what that looks like moving forward. But the announcement that was made last summer, I guess it was, on the renewables pause had a lot more to do with our electricity grid than it had to do with liking or not liking renewables. And here's why. So our electricity grid in Alberta is completely deregulated, which is unlike the way that it is in any other province. So generation, transmission, distribution, all of these different elements of getting electricity from the source, which could be coal. It's not anymore in Alberta, but could be natural gas, which is what 60% of our grid is currently run on, which is why the net zero commitments that the federal government is forcing on Alberta are such a problem, because we have so far to go off of natural gas at this point. They can come from hydro, which we don't have that much of, which other provinces have a lot of. It could come from nuclear, which we, again, don't have that much of. Other provinces have more of. Or it can come from wind and solar and natural sources like that. Yeah. The reason why they went in to do a review actually has a lot to do with our story of oil and gas orphaned and abandoned wells as well. So when we started going in and drilling wells, we obviously have a huge unfunded liability on orphan wells in this province, which is a problem. And also for the environmentalists, one of the biggest sources of methane into the atmosphere. So they are a huge environmental problem. One of the reasons why that issue in particular is a problem is because there was not a wholesome remediation and liability management thought out about that at the outset. And so you have now liability frameworks that are in place if you're, you know, drilling, and there's certain things that you have to do to restore whatever area you're in.
You gotta clean it up after.
Exactly. That currently does not exist for renewables projects. And I am all for a renewables project. I am all for clean energy. Obviously, our world is transitioning more to that. But there is environmental impact from renewables projects. I'm not saying it's more. I'm just saying if you build, for example, a wind farm or a solar farm on prime agricultural land, don't forget, in Alberta, generation is privately funded. So it is private actors who decide to build a wind farm, a solar farm, to have natural gas, hydro, whatever it is. So we did not, before this review, have a plan of how much natural gas do we need? How much renewables do we need? And remember, renewables do not offer reliable baseload energy. We saw the alerts that we had earlier this month where we could have had rolling blackouts because of the insufficient baseload energy. And so what I believe the government was trying to do with this renewables pause was to say, listen, we need to discuss what a transmission plan for this province looks like. Because at this point, private generators build an energy source, and then the government is responsible, the taxpayer actually is responsible for the transmission costs that connect that source of power to the grid. So you could have, like, Joel could decide that over in this farmer's field, he wants to build a solar plant and build it and tell the government that he wants to put it online. And the government would have to build transmission costs out there. There wouldn't necessarily be a process for whether that was built on, like, really good agricultural land. And so that was the crux of why the review was happening, is that none of that was being thought about at the outset. And so, yeah, I know that's a kind of a complicated topic, but I'm really passionate about it because it while it's easy to say that it's because the government does not like renewables, I don't think that's the whole story.
No, you put that really well, actually. And I'm sitting here sitting back to all the conversations I've had about it. And I had no answer, because all my more liberal friends would be sending me these headlines and links, and I would be reading through and I'd just say, oh boy, I don't know what's going on here. So that tracks and makes a lot of sense, actually. It's almost as though they're trying to avoid a mistake they made in the past.
Yes, and of course it doesn't sound good. Like, it doesn't sound good when you're like pausing renewables projects, like, oh, would you hate clean energy? Like, no, especially in the context of what's happening federally, et cetera. But that's why, and I don't blame people for not understanding it, because our electricity system is such a complicated public policy topic. I've literally spent the past 5 years like working on it, understanding it, and I probably only know a fraction of what really smart people on the topic know. So I don't blame people for not understanding, but it's not a hate for renewables.
All I know is if you don't get my heating bill down somehow.
Oh my gosh, I know.
It's a joke. I don't even know how people are making it through. So it's definitely an issue in this province. It's probably, for me, outside of healthcare, one of my biggest problems that I'm bad in are overdose and drug problem. But yeah, otherwise, that wasn't necessarily touched on, and there was a little bit with the mental health problems. But I think for me, you've covered a lot of the stuff that I wanted to chat about. I saw some encouraging things from an Edmontonian perspective. It was a meh thing. I wanted to see more. I believe it's going to be a hard sell. Always will be the healthcare file. Everyone's got their own opinion, and our current population really struggles with complex topics right now. And whether it be because of how we consume media, or whether it's because of the short form nature of TikTok and Instagram, I don't know what it is. It's going to make it even harder and harder moving forward to do these sorts of things. So I wish everyone the best of luck. And for anybody who is uninterested in learning things via Instagram Reel and wants to read, I highly recommend Pocket Lobbyist. Can you please tell people about what you got going on there? Because I really do truly enjoy it. I don't allow a lot of newsletters into my inbox anymore, and I really appreciate yours.
Well, thank you. We work really hard on it. I think so. Pocket Lobbyist is a company that I started about a year and a half ago because, you know, I am a lobbyist. I have a boutique consulting practice. I've been a lobbyist for almost the past decade in and around politics in Alberta. One of the things that I noticed in my lobbying sphere is people really look down on the profession. They think like lobbyists are dirty or corrupt or whatever. But, you know, to me, it's always been about empowering people to mitigate political risk as business risk, just like you do financial risk, just like you do human resource risk, just like you do any other kind of risk within your business. And so we started Pocket Lobbyist because we wanted people to start thinking about political risk as business risk and stop thinking that they needed to just like outsource their government relations and public policy needs to somebody who could do it for them because they just didn't want to be associated. Being a lobbyist is about communicating with the government, which most people do. So if you're doing that, if you're communicating with the government to influence, you are a lobbyist, essentially. And so we wanted to just really democratize that idea and give people access to like briefing notes, backgrounders, assets that we would build in our capacity to support clients that we make available for people so that they don't have to say, I don't know how Alberta's electricity system works. They can just download our briefing note on it and then they can understand.
Yeah. And they don't have to go to a news source that is so unfairly biased in one direction or the other and then generate their opinion that way. I truly do love reading it because it keeps me from opening other crap. So thank you so much for all the effort that you put into it, because I know it is stressful. I do follow you personally and I see it.
Thank you. My mental load is high, but it's okay. I'm going to sort out my adrenal fatigue this year. It's my goal and it'll be all good.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Mel. It's always a pleasure, and you always teach me something. So thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon.